Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Leanna Byrne, and on this edition, France's President Emmanuel Macron is fighting to form a new government and pass next year's budget. But will it calm the country's economic turmoil?
We may have theoretically a shutdown from January the 1st if there's no budget at that time.
It doesn't sound like it. Meanwhile, a British hedge fund trader is jailed for defrauding Denmark out of over $1 billion. How did he pull off one of the biggest tax scams in history? And are you going electric? Have you got range anxiety? You can contact us on WhatsApp or send us a voice note on 0044 330 678 3033, because we're going to be covering that story. Or you can just email us anytime on world.business@bbc.co.uk. But first, let's start in France. President Emmanuel Macron's decision to delay announcing his new prime minister until Friday morning might just put a pause on the political turmoil, but it's not going to solve the country's deepening economic challenges overnight. Mr. Macron has cut short his visit to Poland to return home and focus on finalising next year's budget. His government is under pressure to address rising debt levels and economic stagnation, while also navigating Thursday's decision by the European Central Bank to cut its key interest rate to 3%. ECB President Christine Lagarde has said she expects inflation to stabilise across the eurozone. However, she warned that economic growth for member states, including France, will be slower than previously forecast over the coming years.
The economy grew by 0.4% in the third quarter, exceeding expectations. But the latest information suggests it is losing momentum. Surveys indicate that manufacturing is still contracting and growth in services is slowing.
Now, the rate cut may ease some concerns among France's European neighbours, who have been nervously watching its debt crisis unfold amid a lack of clear strategy to tackle it. So what will happen with the French economy next? Well, I put that to Thomas Michalski, an associate economics professor at the HEC Business School in Paris.
We don't have a budget for the next year. Given that, we may have theoretically a shutdown from January the 1st. That probably will not happen. If there's no budget at that time, there is a possibility that President Macron will use a special Article 16 of the Constitution granting him special powers, and he's going to give a budget by decree. What is more likely to happen is that tomorrow we will have a new prime minister that has tried to form a government and to pass some intermediary budget that is just going to enable, for example, payment of wages of the public sector, etc. And then this new government is going to work on a new budget that is going to amend the provisional one during the first months of 2025.
But do you really think a broad political alliance realistically can pass the tough economic measures really needed to stabilize France's debt and deficit?
That depends on the willingness of the center and left and the Republicans to avoid potentially new elections throughout the course of the new year. Now, of course, there are huge disagreements between them, from starting whether we should raise taxes or not, or what to cut in terms of expenditures or not. So I think that getting a consensus here is pretty grim.
But what are the potential risks if no stable alliance is formed?
Well, the first one is that we're going to have a provisional budget for the rest of the year of 2025. Second of all, if there's no majority government that can agree on anything, we will not have any major reforms that the country needs of various sorts, particularly reforming and modernizing the public sector. And there are huge tensions between the parties that are discussing, for example, the ecologists demand purely and simply just scrapping the retirement age reform, while the socialists want to amend it, and the center or the right wing doesn't want to hear about it. So there's tensions galore.
That was Thomas Michalski, associate economics professor at the HEC Business School in Paris. Now let's hear from Nathalie Oziol from La France Insoumise, meaning France Unbowed, a left-wing party.
We are in the middle of a huge political, economic, and democratic crisis in France. And this crisis is the result of political choices, which are those made by Emmanuel Macron himself. And more particularly, you were talking about a huge deficit. What happened in the last weeks and the last months is Michel Barnier, former prime minister, presented austerity budget bill. And we proposed with amendments to have an alternative budget. And these amendments were adopted. They were voted in parliament. But Michel Barnier chose to use the 49.3 article so that his own budget was imposed instead, which led to his government being toppled, as you know. And so now we are in the same situation as back in July with no government, Macron having to appoint a government, and he is exactly in the same situation where he does not want to respect the result of the election in July, the snap elections, which he provoked. This, again, is a source of aggravation of the crisis.
Just let's talk about the proposals in your budget. Included in that, it was higher taxes on corporations and the wealthy. I mean, some critics argue that that could risk further damaging investment, job creation and economic growth at a really critical moment.
Well, maybe we could agree on the fact that the current deficit is directly linked to exactly the same economic choices over the years, and more particularly, cuts in expenses, meaning less public services, meaning less funding for hospitals, schools. And this has led to the crisis we know now. Maybe it's time to have another direction, another political orientation. What we propose with the New Popular Front and my party, La France Insoumise, France Unbowed, is rather than cutting expenses, is to raise receipts, taxing the richest fortunes, taxing what we call super profits. So this is basically targeting the multinational companies. We're not talking about small companies, and so on and so forth.
Now, well, fairness is important. Would those wage raises, would that come from the increase in tax on the wealthy? Because, I mean, sometimes studies suggest that even if taxes, those kind of taxes were implemented, it's a lot of the time they don't generate enough revenue to cover the fiscal shortfalls.
Well, the fortune of the wealthiest people in the country would cover a lot of changes, such as, yes, raising wages and raising minimum wages.
That was Nathalie Auziol from La France Insoumise. I've got Kerry Leahy, economist at Columbia University in New York. Hello, Kerry. Kerry, can you hear me?
Hello.
Hello. Just a little bit of
a
delay. That's all right. Well, let's go back to the European Central Bank's decision to cut interest rates to 3%. We've got weak growth in the Eurozone.
Yes.
So, Kerry, do you think that's going to counteract the slowdown?
Well, I don't know if it will necessarily counteract it, but it may mitigate it. And I think they're just trying to keep the ship afloat at some kind of positive growth rate. And I think the markets are anticipating further reductions because the economy still isn't growing a full 1% across the board. So anything that will sort of stabilize that at a relatively low rate, I think will be welcome. But that only happen, I think, in the minds of the marketplace if the ECB continues to cut rates, perhaps aggressively next year.
And what are your thoughts, Kerry? Where does France fit into all of this?
Well, France is a mess, obviously. The only good news for the marketplace is that the mess hasn't rolled over and had contagion effects on other countries. In other words, in the fact that the so-called borrowing spreads in France, which have widened, hasn't spilled over to other countries, making it worse for them. But this is basically a problem where you have a slow-growing economy with a large public sector that needs to tighten its belt, raise taxes.
Exactly.
And like almost every G7 country, it's hard to do that.
Well, speaking of major Eurozone economies, Germany is feeling the effects of sluggish growth, especially in its car industry. And Volkswagen has announced plans to close several factories. That's a story that echoes really what's happened in the UK 18 years ago when Peugeot shut its Ryton plant near Coventry in England. Thousands of workers lost their jobs, and it marked the end of an era for British car manufacturing. And I went to Coventry to look back at Ryton's closure and explore what it can teach us about the challenges the global car industry faces today.
Peugeot are threatening industrial action over plans to close the company's plant at Ryton near Coventry.
The night shift at Ryton left this evening shortly after clocking on. They'd been sent home early to absorb some bad news from France. Peugeot has decided that a long history of car making here will soon be over.
18 years ago today, a grey Peugeot 206 rolled off the production line at the Ryton plant near Coventry in the West Midlands of England. It was the last car to be made there, ending over 60 years of car manufacturing at the site. That closure marked a seismic shift, not just for Coventry, but for the entire UK automotive industry. More than 2,000 workers lost their jobs as production moved to Slovakia, a decision driven by cost-cutting and the lure of cheaper labour in Eastern Europe.
Ryton hasn't been invested in as well as it should have been over the years. And perhaps it is just back to British jobs being quicker, cheaper and easier to get rid of.
That's Jim O'Boyle, who worked at Ryton for nearly 19 years and was the union convener during its final days. Now he's a Coventry city councillor and remembers the closure as a defining moment.
18 years ago, I remember being in the convener's office for the last time. I remember shutting the door. I even locked it. I don't know why. I went down to personnel because the then head of HR wanted to say goodbye, but she wasn't there. And I hung around. She wasn't there. So I just turned around and went out and I never saw her ever again. And it was quite a sad moment, really, and it was something where 18 and a half years of your life, and I was thinking about all those people who had left, what were going to happen to them. You know, I was technically unemployed as they were. How was the future going to look? And it was uncertain, and I was worried about it. And I was worried not just for me, I was worried for 2,500 people.
Standing opposite a Christmas market in the centre of Coventry, Councillor O'Boyle reflects on the closure with his former colleague, Des Quinn, who worked at Ryton and is now Unite's National Officer for Automotive.
The thing that always sticks in my mind is the people. We knew it was a big workplace, but we knew nearly everyone. Yeah. You know, and where the union office was in the middle of the plant, as shifts were changing over, people had come in, they'd come in and have a go at you. Sometimes it was because they were annoyed at something. Sometimes it was just a bit of a laugh and a joke, you know. And I had reservations about going there at the end because I didn't want to see the plant empty. Yeah. And I look back now and wish to myself sometimes I had done. I don't know I miss the plant, but I miss the people.
The story at Ryton was part of a broader trend, the decline of UK manufacturing in the face of globalisation. But still, it was a bitter blow for Coventry, which was once Britain's motor city. In fact, the first ever British car was built there by Dahmer in 1897. Councillor O'Boyle says, at the time, it left Coventry grappling with its identity and future.
To be honest with you, since the 1980s, we've really been trying to understand, you know, what is the thing that Coventry is known for now? What is our unique selling point?
And, as Des Quinn puts it, Ryton's closure had a direct impact on Coventry's local economy.
Sometimes when I drive that way, I drive places, past places like the newsagents I used to use. It's shut, gone. And that was pretty soon after Ryton shut, because it opened early for the Ryton workforce, you know. And we know pubs and clubs that have shut, and that again was on the back of that disposable income that people had that they haven't got now.
Today, car makers globally are facing new challenges, but the outcome for many workers is similar. Declining demand, high production costs and the race to electrify have created immense pressure. Across Europe, the challenges are similar. Stellantis, which owns brands like Peugeot, Fiat and Chrysler, reported a 50% drop in profits earlier this year. Meanwhile, Chinese automakers like BYD and NIO are gaining ground with lower cost electric cars, outpacing European rivals in both innovation and affordability. David Bailey is a motoring expert and the professor of business economics at the Birmingham Business School.
Today, the big challenge is very much from China, where labour costs are even lower, much, much lower. And so there's a big kind of competitive threat, I think, for the European and British industries, in terms of automotive at least, which really could be existential. So different parts of the world have responded to that in different ways. In the US, over 100% tariffs on Chinese imports. In Europe, tariffs of up to 35 to 45%. The UK has got to make a decision whether to follow suit.
In fact, the challenges Germany's automotive industry faces today bear a striking resemblance to Ryton's story.
I think there's some big issues for automotive makers in Europe and the UK in that they have not gone down the electric route quickly enough. They've not been able, therefore, to get costs down, and they are being outcompeted by the Chinese. So there needs to be a huge effort to electrify, maybe with the support of tariffs and a better industrial strategy to help firms make the transition.
There are glimmers of hope. Coventry is vying to host a gigafactory for battery production. Jim O'Boyle sees this as an opportunity to reclaim the city's automotive legacy.
We need to build for the future because the economy of yesterday is going to be the economy of tomorrow. So upskilling the people, upskilling workers, but also investing with companies, because ultimately it's not the government, it's not me, it's not the trade unions, it's the companies that will create the jobs and actually make the economy go round.
That was Councillor Jim O'Boyle ending that report. And you're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, let's talk about this landmark case. A court in Denmark has handed a British hedge fund trader, Sanjay Shah, a 12-year prison sentence for his role in a massive tax fraud scheme worth $1.3 billion. Shah was found guilty of orchestrating a scam where he falsely claimed tax refunds on behalf of companies he controlled. The scheme defrauded the Danish state over a three-year period, starting in 2012. And I spoke to the BBC's Adrian Murray, who was in court today.
It's a big trial here in Denmark. There's been a huge media following. Shah entered the court wearing a navy hoodie and a red Santa Claus hat. And then he took his seat beside his lawyers and listened very sort of calmly and with quite a straight face as the judge handed down the verdict. He was being sentenced to 12 years. This is the maximum possible sentence for this type of crime. They also continued to say that they would also confiscate around $1 billion worth of his assets that was equivalent to about 80% of the amount that had been defrauded from the Danish state. He didn't say any comment at that time, but his lawyers did say immediately that they will appeal the case.
Now, until I kind of read around this case, I was very unfamiliar with what's called a cum-ex trading scheme. What is that and why is it so significant in this case?
They are a very, very complex type of trading scheme, and it's something that reportedly took off post the financial crisis. Now, in this case in particular, Danish prosecutors accused Shah of being the mastermind of a trading scheme where he was undergoing multiple complex trades very rapidly just before the date that a dividend was due to be declared to shareholders. This sort of causes confusion, this rapid series of buying and selling. And ultimately, it means you can double or duplicate the claim for a tax rebate on the dividend.
Who did this fraud target?
Well, it actually targeted the Danish Treasury, the tax body, because they were the ones that refunded this money over basically taxes that had never been paid in the first place. So there was this sort of duplication going on, but that money came from the coffers of the state of Denmark. As we say, it's a substantial amount. This is 9 billion Danish kroner. So that's actually £1 billion or $1.35 billion. It's a significant amount. And that's also why this has been the maximum penalty that's been awarded in this case. 12 years is the maximum sentence. It's actually the biggest sentence ever given in any kind of fraud trial in Denmark.
So Mr. Shah, he denied any wrongdoing, but how did he react?
He's insisted on his innocence from the beginning. He's said, and throughout his defence throughout this whole case has been, that he was acting lawfully, or at least in good faith, and he thought he was acting lawfully. But as the verdict was read out, he really was quite expressionless. He just stood there and took it and listened. And then as he actually left the court at the end, when he was going back into the custody, he put back on his red Santa Claus hat. And as he passed the reporters, he smiled and said, "See you next year."
Adrian Murray there. We've still got Kerry Leahy, economist at Columbia University in New York. Kerry, Warner Brothers Discovery splitting its business into two divisions. Seems like investors quite liked that. Kerry?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes.
Sorry.
Investors seem to like Warner Brothers Discovery splitting its business into two divisions. What's the backstory there?
Well, this is a great tradition on Wall Street, that when you announce a restructuring where you get rid of the assets nobody really wants, which we refer to in this business as cable, and you put more attention and focus on what could expand, which is streaming, that's a win-win for the marketplace, particularly in a new presidential administration is going to look very favorable on any kinds of big deals. And so the market loved that, and the price of Warner stock was up 15%.
What does that say about the streaming industry right now?
Well, it certainly has issues, and I think the attitude is going to be once they're split up, they'll probably join up with another. I think there's going to be probably a considerable number of mergers in that business and have fewer players and have an industry that's a lot less balkanized, which is another reason why the market is excited, because they think Warner gets split up, it's more likely to merge with another, or at least the streaming part of the business will merge with another streaming business, and that would be a way to generate revenues, profits, and fees.
Yeah. All right, Kerry, thank you so much, Kerry Leahy, joining us for the markets. Now, picture this, a tiny quintessential New England town where the general store isn't just a place to grab milk or mail a letter, it's the beating heart of the community. Welcome to Coburn's General Store in Stafford, Vermont. For 47 years, Melvin Coburn and his wife Sue have been the guardians of this local treasure, which also actually happens to be the favourite spot of the town's most famous son, singer-songwriter Noah Kahan, who mentions his hometown in his songs. But now his beloved gathering place faces an uncertain future, and the Coburns are ready to retire, and the community that was led by Noah's mother, of all people, is rallying to save it. And I caught up with Melvin to hear about the store, the fight to save it, and what the future holds for this slice of Vermont life.
We sell pretty much everything. We sell, you know, full line of groceries pretty much. We have a meat department where we have a full-time meat cutter. We sell beer and wine, tobacco, produce, dairy products. We have a small hardware section, and we have a post office. My wife always called it the mini mall.
You guys have been running the store for 47 years. Is it? What does it mean for you and your family to run that store?
It's something that I've always wanted to do when I was a kid. I grew up in Stratford. I've always lived in Stratford. So it's something, you know, I've always enjoyed. And even back then, one of my kind of goals in life was to be able to own my own general store and to be able to have a general store in the town that you grew up in. So, you know, most of the people and most of the people, you know, most of the people know you as well. It's just something that I absolutely have always wanted to do, and I truly love doing it. I always have since we bought it 47 years ago. It's just been a dream come true for me and my wife.
It sounds really special, but you recently went through tough times with the business, didn't you?
Well, I went through tough times with my health. I had health problems, and we kind of thought in the back of our mind, and we were getting along in age as well, that, you know, the time would come pretty soon when we would have to put it up for sale. And 2 years ago, we decided to do that. We figured it was time.
But the community didn't want you to give it up. They rallied around to save the store. They even set up a nonprofit trust to help with funding. What was your reaction when you first saw that level of support?
It was a great feeling to know when we said we were going to put it up for sale. There was a person in town, Trudy Brock, who said, gee, you know, we don't want the store to close. And we said, you know, that's not going to happen. The store isn't going to close. We'll stay there as long as we have to keep the store going. And at that time, she said that there might be a group of people in town that would be willing to kind of form a group to buy the store, which has happened in, you know, quite a few towns in Vermont, 6 or 8 different towns. They've done the same thing.
Great. And the country music singer Noah Kahan, he grew up frequenting your store. He's been a really big vocal supporter of this campaign. I mean, what did that feel like for you seeing that?
It's a good feeling, not only that Noah is interested in keeping the store going, but just, you know, there's so many people in town that I guess really appreciate what the store means to the town, you know, and they don't want to see it close, and that's not going to happen. And you know, Noah, I think, has been a supporter of trying to keep the store going. His mother is kind of one on the committee that's kind of in charge of fundraising and everything. They feel it's really important to keep the store going in town, which is certainly the way I feel, too. I feel that every small town should have some kind of a general store, a country store. I think it's really needed. And unfortunately, that's, you know, been going downhill over the years. It's harder and harder for small stores to really compete with the larger chains and everything. And a lot of towns have lost their little country store. But as I say, we've been very fortunate to have the support from townspeople and surrounding towns have supported this very well over the years too. So that's just been a, it's been a pleasure to see that, really.
And that was Melvin Coburn, who owns Coburn's General Store in Stafford, Vermont. I still got Kerry Leahy with me. Kerry, you're a big shot in New York.
I'm here.
Hello, I'm glad you're still here. You're obviously a big shot in New York, Kerry, but I mean, can you relate to that in any way, that story?
Oh, absolutely. You're talking about an enormous convenience of having people that know the product, know what people want, and the problem they're running into is they probably can't find another couple or several individuals who want to put in the kind of hours to turn a job into a passion and run a business that has a little bit of everything for a client base that's relatively small.
Well, you know, yeah, exactly. And, you know, they're being squeezed from every angle, from online shops to inflation to, you know, just mom and pop stores being shoved out, essentially. Well, Kerry Leahy, economist at Columbia University in New York, thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our producers today, Craig Henderson and Victoria Holland, who are big Noah Kahan fans. That's World Business Report from the BBC World Service.